This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we're going to talk about behavior and its unsung role in innovation and in connecting the dots. After all, being an innovator means more than just having great ideas. It means you found a way to get those ideas done. No one knows this better than Kyle Nell. He's the executive director at Lowe's Innovation Labs. He's not the typical tech guy or engineer, but a behavioral scientist. Under Kyle, Lowe's has developed some pretty futuristic solutions, from autonomous robotic systems to a hollow room to a partnership with NASA that put a 3D printer in space. Today, he'll explain the importance of behavior in innovation and what it means to deconstruct decision-making or manufacture serendipity. He'll also explain why he hires writers and illustrators to make custom comic books for executives and how it's helped make real change happen at Lowe's. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by BNY Mellon Wealth Management, who knows that your investment decisions define not just your future, but your legacy. BNY Mellon Wealth Management knows because they know you well. This gives them the insights to help grow, protect, and transfer your wealth. Visit their brand hub, Worth Knowing, on entrepreneur.com to learn more. Disclaimer, BNY Mellon is the corporate brand of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation and its subsidiaries.
Hi, Kyle. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
We're excited to have you, and I think that this conversation is going to be incredibly fascinating. But I want to get everybody up to speed. Can you give us sort of the highlight reel of some of the projects that you've helped make a reality at the Lowe's Innovation Labs?
Yeah, in no particular order. We created the largest virtual augmented and mixed reality retail solutions or systems. And we've been doing that for the past five, almost 6 years now. So in partnerships with Microsoft and Google and others to bring these things into the real world. So that's been really exciting. And we've also built the first autonomous robots that have been in use for the past 3 years in pretty much all of Northern California now in our stores. So these robots talk to you. You talk to it. They speak multiple languages. And they know the real-time location of every single object inside the store. They also do inventory tracking, which may not sound as exciting on the outside, but for a retailer, it's a big deal. We also built exosuits with Virginia Tech that a number of our stores are using both in the U.S. and in Canada. And these are non-electronic, non-motorized exosuits that basically use carbon fiber rods to collect potential energy and turn it into kinetic energy. Essentially, it relieves about 20 to 40 pounds of weight all day long for our store associates. Big deal if you're stocking shelves all day. Who wouldn't want to wear an exosuit to work, right? We've done a number of different things with partners like with the UN and with partners like Singularity University and others. We even put a 3D printer in the International Space Station with our friends at Made in Space. And so the first commercially manufactured object off of the planet is a Lowe's wrench that the astronauts actually use. So many other things too, in additive manufacturing and others, but those are some of the big ones.
And Kyle, if you don't mind, how do you explain your job to people who've never met you?
That's a great question. I have a really hard time with this at neighborhood parties. What I help organizations do things that they want to do but don't know how to do. And the two things that are attached to that is identifying what to work on, and then getting people to actually change their behavior to work together that would never work together in a way to get them to do that thing that they say they want to do. So pretty much every organization on the planet says they want to do big, bold, quote unquote, disruptive things. it's very, very hard for them to do that. And the main reason for that is human behavior issues. And that's what I help them do.
Very good. And tell us how on earth we get here, right? What was your life before Lowe's? You're a researcher. You've done a lot of academic work. Tell me how we got here.
Yeah. So I was always interested about how people make decisions, and then really interested in the chasm between what people say they want and then what people actually do. And especially intrigued by that when it comes from individuals working together in groups, and then those problems persist and compound on each other. And I think everyone's had this experience where you've worked at one organization and it's weird in its own way. And then you go to another organization, it's weird in a different way. So organizations almost become individual people in and of themselves, and they have their own personalities and their own proclivities and things. So I was just really interested about how these take shape, and then how to help those organizations and people in those organizations overcome those issues so they can actually do what they want to do. So anyways, I did that to try to save the world, basically. So I did that thing where my wife and I went and worked and lived in the jungle in Costa Rica, and we did all that crazy stuff trying to help people that were clear cutting the rainforest and that beautiful biological corridor that we all tried to save when we were in middle school. And I just learned that these were not technical problems. These weren't policy problems. The policy and the technical issues had already been solved. It came down to a fundamental human issue, one-to-one and in groups. And I just found that was the real core issue that no one was really addressing. So then I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin. It was great. And I studied really how people make decisions, and particularly in marketing research and experimental design methodologies of how that all comes together. And once again, I just saw all these issues were all human behavior issues. And then I decided I wanted to go apply these principles that I was studying and things into the biggest, baddest organization I could find, and somehow wormed my way into working at Walmart. At the corporate headquarters there, and just saw like the power of large organizations to be able to affect significant change very quickly. If you could once again kind of hack the system and use that behavioral science and change to be able to make things happen, and I had some success there. And then I got recruited from Walmart to go to Lowe's, where things really started to take off, and I was able to turn some of these kind of half-baked ideas into something more specific that ended up becoming the Lowe's Innovation Labs.
And you could have just stayed in academia. Why?
Yeah.
What sort of draws you to sort of actually applying these to practical, tangible solutions that can actually be used in real daily life?
I wanted to do stuff. I wanted things that were being discovered to be applied very quickly. And what better laboratory than a large living organization and business? And so I think the most powerful principle, or the most powerful structure, is experimental design. Your basic hypothesis testing, dependent, independent variable testing, and just iterating very, very quickly to be able to make stuff happen, to learn quickly and apply, learn and apply, learn and apply. And in academia, you are learning, but there's little less applying. And in business, I found there was a lot more learning and applying, but it was very, very bucketed and not shared more broadly. So I wanted to try to break some of those silos and try to bring in the great stuff that was happening in academia and apply it in the real world, and then be able to funnel that back into academia. And that's what we've been able to do. One of the things that came out of it is a good friend of mine who is a recovering tenured professor. We were able to help him start a company called Neurons Inc., which is an applied neuroscience company. And that company is publicly being used by Facebook and Google and many, many, many others now. Basically, what you do is wear a high-res EEG headset, eye-tracking goggles, and we can diagnostically see what's working and not working in new experiences or existing experiences, whether in store or in a virtual reality experiment or something like that. And this gives us all kinds of understanding of how behavior is actually playing out in real time, and then we can make changes accordingly. So, that's a very academic thing that became a very practical, highly used company that's growing quite quickly, actually. So those are kind of examples of bringing it to the real world and the business world to academia.
Sort of on that topic of sort of this gap between maybe big ideas and actual practical applications, you and I talked a little bit before about the great man myth, sort of, and how it's lacking and sort of the dangers of it. Can you just explain to people what that is? What is the great man myth?
Yeah, the great man myth is the way that history is usually taught or has been taught in the past. I think it's changing, but. But basically, history is through a series of great man stories, you know, Christopher Columbus and all of these kinds of big, George Washington and Martin Luther and all this stuff, which is true. I mean, there are some great, great men and great, great women, but that's never the story. It's not, you know, Martin Luther King was a wonderful, wonderful man, but he was not the only one marching on Selma, right? There are movements that happen all together. That maybe are emblematic in one person, but that's by no means the only thing happening during that time. And so I see innovation happening in the exact same way, right? We tell these great man stories that these people become almost magical and untouchable and unknowable. You know, Steve Jobs has reached that level for sure. Elon Musk is there. And Einstein, I mean, you hear these people, even Tesla, and you hear these people and you think, oh, they're just these unknowable geniuses. But when you really start to deconstruct and look at what they've built and what they're doing, they're applying similar kinds of principles, whether intuitively or they've created their own system and they're applying it that way. But you can learn from what they've done and successes and the failures that they've had and then try to create, I believed, to try to create a system that could be applied at any organization to create these magical kinds of unexpected innovations and changes. And for me, that's what innovation really is. It's a dramatic change. Anyways, and so that's what I wanted to set out to do. I wanted to work for a company that was that had impact, but was where innovation was not really expected. Not innovation in the sense of, you know, improvement, but big dramatic, you know, tech usually associated innovation. And that's why I choose to work at Lowe's. I wanted to be able to prove out these principles at a place that no one really saw coming and be able to say, like, hey, if Lowe's can build autonomous robots, if Lowe's can do virtual and augmented reality at scale, if we can put a 3D printer in the International Space Station, like it's really opens up the gates for every organization to do big, bold things. And, you know, from a personal level, that's where I see all of the big, awesome change that we need in this planet to take place is going to happen from traditional companies and organizations are going to be the ones that are going to have to take the lead on that.
And for the regular person, that great man myth, what is the danger there of just sort of seeing these people as superheroes?
Yeah, the problem with that, like, I think the superhero is a perfect thing, right? If you believe that Superman is around, then you don't really, if the building's on fire, you're probably not as concerned about going out and trying to take care of it yourself, right? And so if there's this belief that there are these super metahumans taking care of the world's biggest problems, then that kind of takes away your personal responsibility for making that change and making those futures happen. And that's the danger. The real awesome big change is going to happen, I believe, from traditional organizations making those dramatic changes and leaps. Not only from these truly great people like that I laid out before, but all, from everybody. So we all have a responsibility. And I think the great man idea kind of diminishes our belief that we can do these big things, which we can, no question about it.
And I think it brings us to a unique thing that you've done at Lowe's, which is the science fiction prototyping. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
So why don't we take a step back, and I think it probably makes sense to kind of explain how I got there. Everyone's, I think, had this experience, right, where you're trying to convince important people to do stuff that they're not used to doing. And the way that we convince important people to do stuff is make a killer PowerPoint presentation. And that's what I did too, right? I would spend days and days and hours crafting what I thought were these amazing, convincing PowerPoints. And no matter what organization I was at, I would give these presentations, and then almost always, luckily, you know, I'd walk out of the meeting and those people would say, Kyle, it was a great presentation. What an awesome presentation. And then almost always nothing ever happened from that presentation. And that would drive me crazy. The only reason I gave the presentation was to affect a change. And if it didn't affect a change, then it was a waste of everyone's collective time and effort. So I said, there has to be a better way, and started looking around for other ways to convince people, A, to show people what's possible, and then B, convince them to affect a change. And I tried a bunch of different things that didn't work, but the one that did work, and I saw when I was in academia, was the power of story. You know, when the aliens finally come down or reveal themselves, the thing that I think is most uniquely human is not our use of tools or anything else. I think it's our use of story. You know, if you think about it, stories are so bizarre. We love them so much that we will forego food and sleep and money and all kinds of things to be able to consume stories. And we'll even watch and love the same stories over and over again. But then when you get into an organization, we don't really use story in the way that we could. We explain things in a chronological series of events at best. And so I was a little bit shocked that that wasn't happening. Anyway, so I thought, well, why don't we use this uniquely human, innate, universal thing to identify what to work on and then also to convince people what to do? So I decided, let's hire some science fiction writers. So we hire – this is really what we do. There's a whole process and rigor of this that I won't go into, but we hire professional published science fiction writers, our marketing research and trend data, send them off in different directions, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road. And then we give them a primary location of the story. So say Cleveland in 10 years. And that's really the only direction that we give them initially. And these different science fiction writers who don't talk to each other will then come back to us with stories that they think are representative of what's going to happen with that possible probable convergence of tech and people trends. So think like Back to the Future Part 2. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the background of that story that may be not relevant to the characters in the story because they just take it for granted. But for us in the past, that is hugely revelatory. And you can see how these things not it's not just a story about robotics, but it's how robotics plus this thing plus that thing plus the other all fit in together. So then we turn those back to the behavioral science. We not only use stories, but these are real stories with characters and a conflict and a narrative arc. And then we take those stories and we put them into some sort of unexpected manifestation. And usually it's a comic book. So we literally turn these short stories into comic books. And I will produce comic books and literally pass them out to our executive team. So all of the chiefs. And we will read stories. And no PowerPoint. We will sit down and read these stories. And then we debate and talk about the story and the outcomes of those things rather than the individual capabilities that will need to be created in order to make those stories a reality. And the first time we ever did that was way, way, way back, actually a few weeks before Oculus Rift came out on Kickstarter. And it was a story about a day in the life of this couple. And they part of their day was they were using what we would call mixed and augmented reality to redo their kitchen. And they were doing that in their kitchen. And I can share some of that with you later. And at the time, it was heretical. I mean, it was insane to think that augmented and mixed reality would reach a point in the near future where that would be the possibility, let alone the standard. And it created a whole set of different conversations than I'd ever seen before, where we were really focused outcomes rather than current capabilities and what it would take to make that happen. So from that, they said, yeah, we believe it. Let's do it. Our CEO was totally behind it. The rest of the executive team was totally behind it. I said, yeah, go ahead and build it. I was like, okay, cool. So I walked out of that meeting going, all right. I don't really know anything about virtual augmented or mixed reality, but we'll start to go ahead and make this thing happen. And we did. Within 3 weeks, we had a working, terrible, but working prototype that we put into a store in Canada to test. And we used the applied neuroscience testing through Neurons Inc. to be able to understand what was working and not working. And then we began to iterate very quickly to the point of where it is today. And that's just one way. We've done that in every single phase with robotics, with additive manufacturing, with exosuits. We've taken that exact same course. Story first. Story becomes our guiding principle. And then we create prototypes. We work with what we call uncommon partners, and then we build stuff and we iterate very quickly using applied neuroscience.
And you mentioned this. You say, oh, so we just hired these writers and we got the comic books. But let's just rewind a little bit. At some point, you had a conversation with someone that said, "Hey, I've got this cockamamie idea." How does that go? You know, what is going through your mind when you say, "Hey, I think we should read comic books"? Like, can you take us back to that moment?
Yeah. So I didn't start with, "Hey, let's get some comic books." It was more of an escalation of commitment, quite frankly. Once again, back to the behavioral science stuff. First of all, I was identifying like, "Hey, we got a core problem here." And that core problem is we are not getting the movement that we all say we want. And everyone agrees with that. I don't care which organization you're in. I don't think any executive team in the world is like, "Hey, I think we've got it all figured out. And we're perfect." And so there was that really deep understanding that there was a real problem there and we needed to innovate meaningfully. And then the other was like, okay, well, let's try this and see what happens. So I really focus more on the story aspect and the future story and the understanding of that future rather than the manifestation and saying, "Hey, we're going to make a bunch of comic books and we're going to forego strategic decision making for this little thing and just do comic book based strategic decision making." That probably wouldn't have flown, but the story did, and the understanding that what we've been doing isn't exactly working. So that's kind of how it all went. And then it just continued to iterate and build since then to the point of where it's so commonplace now that that's what we do that I just don't think that Lowe's could imagine doing looking at the future in any other way than doing it through story.
And what guides you through those conversations? What's your gut check? You have an initial conversation, you have an initial thought, and then someone says something, and then you've got to guide that process to sort of figure out the next step. How do we push this thing forward? What's the capability that you're depending on yourself to sort of navigate through waters that, you know, not only has Lowe's not done, but you've not done either, right? How do you do that? What capability do you depend on?
So yeah, great question. So the real thing for me is if you believe that the actual problem is an organizational problem and not a technical one, you start to address organizational problems like technical ones. So for me, it was like laying out what I believe to be the explicit and the implicit decision making structure for how things got done, and what I believed, like literally laying it out and trying to align incentives for various people that I would need to get on board on these various things so that it would all kind of line up at least so that we could start to move forward. And I don't know if I've ever seen anybody else really sit down and think about organizational structure that specifically and that intently. And for us, that really, really worked. And when I say for us, I mean the Lowe's Innovation Labs was me for the first year. I was the only person. And so to like really lay it out and start to look at it like an experimental design, and then to continue to experiment, iterate. And that was I think the key to the success. I don't have all the answers. The only thing that I think that works very, very well is I can identify like where the holes are and start to convince people to help me to build tools to kind of bridge those gaps. And like applied neuroscience is a great example of that. So even with the stories, in the early stages of the stories, we test people reading those stories using high-res EEG headsets and eye tracking goggles. So we can understand where people are getting tripped up on wording. If the wording is awkward, if the phrasing is awkward, if there's not enough action, if there's too much action, like all of those things are really, really important. So it's the time that you get to actually pitching it to the executive team, they're really focused on the ideas, not tripping over your awkward phraseology or flow is awkward. So we can really test the idea rather than the structure or the way it was given. And the same thing happens too in every single meeting, and just kind of being deliberate that way, I think has served us really well.
And what I think is also interesting is that story is recognized and this given play to in lots of conversations. Oh, understand your story, know your story, right? But I feel like it isn't being maximized in most sectors. Why is that? You know, we recognize that it's powerful, but we don't really tap into it. Why is that?
Oh, yeah. So I think the fundamental problem is that they're learning about stories through a business book perspective, which is not the best way to learn a story, right? If you want to learn about business, you're probably, and the fundamentals of finance, you're probably not going to learn about it through science fiction. You're probably going to go and learn about it through a finance book. In the same way, if you really want to learn about story, you should probably go and learn from the masters. And there are some greats, and even books about the masters. Like Joseph Campbell is probably one of the most influential people that no one really knows about. And those that do are obsessed with him. But I mean, his whole framework is influenced probably all of modern thought, thanks to Star Wars and other things that George Lucas and many of the other people that have directed. And it's like the group myths, I guess, of this phase of humanity. All of those people you can read their books in the way that they think about story and how powerful that is. But no one talks about that in business. And it was shocking to me that's not the case. So those things are out there. They're just not being discussed. Story in a business context is usually reduced, like I said, to a chronological series of events. And that's just not a story.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. Are we having the wrong conversations when we try to solve problems or we try to build new things? You've mentioned that a lot of people will talk about maybe a tech, the technology behind something, but they won't necessarily be talking about the opportunity. Can you talk a little bit more about this? Are we talking about the wrong things when we talk about change?
Yes, no question. Most definitely, especially when it comes, there's two kinds of change, right? So there's the incremental improvement, which is really important, but that's not change, right? If incremental improvement is executing on a plan, what I'm talking about is transformation, which is deviating from a plan, but staying on purpose, if that makes sense. Deviating from a plan for a large organization is the scariest thing ever. And going off of principle and off of purpose alone is something that a startup does, or something in its an organization in its early phase does very well. But a large organization does not do that very well. So for us, it's really about trying to identify that purpose and then allowing for different versions of that purpose in the future to be able to take hold. And the story allows you to do that. It allows you to kind of play out those scenarios in an easier way. Rather than trying to map it out in kind of an IT roadmap fashion, which hardly ever works, especially when it comes to disruptive innovation. And I think that's where a lot of organizations get caught, is trying to map out every little thing rather than trying to have a set of principles and then kind of go into the darkness or into the mist and just trying to work their way along the path.
Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned also that one of the problems that large organizations have is that they're often not thinking about behavior at all, despite the fact that they're running these large teams. You know, how important is it to remember that behavior creates change?
No question. Yeah. So that, I think that's exactly it, right? So the people are more comfortable creating technical specs and programs, and they are addressing organizational issues because it's uncomfortable, right? To be able to say culture is a very hard thing to define and even harder thing to manage. So to be able to like really say that that's the actual problem is or a hindrance or a possible thing that's going to keep us or help us get to that point is very difficult. So kind of flipping that mindset and having an organizational discussion without having the organizational discussion, I think is really important. And that's what the story allows you to do. It allows you to see the benefit of doing these big things rather than discussing all of the unknown challenges and hurdles and technical issues that do exist and will exist. It's really more of like this opportunity focus rather than a risk mitigation, which is typically what happens when you're laying out a large-scale roadmap.
You've talked about sort of the importance of manufacturing serendipity in order to get to big ideas and get big things done. What does that mean? What does it mean to manufacture serendipity?
Yeah, so this goes back to the trying to break down the great man idea, right? So a lot of what they were doing almost seems serendipitous, right? They were just Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak happened to meet, and they were able to build this thing, and they were able to do this stuff, and it almost seems like that, once again, back to the magic of serendipity. And I believe you can manufacture that. And in the same way that we use shorthand terms inside a business from popular science fiction, we all do it, right? It's like the transporter of this. It's like the holodeck of that. I thought we could build a system that was highly rigorous, created all kinds of different structures that big organizations like quantitative measures, and be able to replicate that over and over and over again in different areas, in different fields, working with traditional companies. So we were able to manufacture serendipity essentially in lots of different areas. So manufacture serendipity in additive manufacturing, both in space and on Earth is what we're doing now. Manufacture that for exoskeletons, manufacture that for robotics and for virtual and augmented reality. We've been able to take these principles and the system that is highly rigorous and very complex, and be able to apply it in lots of different areas and spin out a lot and create a lot of value in a relatively short amount of time, and to do a lot at the same time. So that was what I wanted to see if we could prove out, and I think we've proven out that you can do that.
No, that makes sense. It makes sense. And important all this, of course, is just the various decisions that come at every step of the process. What does it mean to deconstruct decision making? Can you sort of outline that for people, help people understand what that is?
Yeah, I think the word is being intentional is probably the better way to think about it. So if you were to really sit back, and everybody does this sort of intuitively, but if you really just sit back and think about the implicit and explicit decision-making structure and also the incentive structure of the people in your organization that you need to convince, cajole, what have you, to get things going, then you might take a different tact about how to move things forward. And I see this with a lot of people too, peers of mine from other places, other companies that are that believe that the tech will set them free. Basically, if you build the better mousetrap, that all of a sudden, magically, the organization will realign itself to that better mousetrap. And that's just not the case. People like to do the same things they always do. They're more comfortable that way. And change is actually the hardest thing, especially if it's good change. And so to be able to really think about that as the primary problem and literally lay out like person X reports to this person, which means that they need this thing. And then I believe that they really want that thing. So I can help them kind of align to this project because it could be helpful for them this way and that way, or they're trying to be more efficient with that thing. And maybe this project could help with that. Just being even that explicit and really just laying it out for those people that you need to convince, I've found to be incredibly helpful. The other thing too, which is tied to that too, is deconstructing it also means constructing the narrative for those people that aren't narrative, you know, quote unquote, like innovation people. So I can't tell you how many times something has been log jammed in legal or somewhere else in risk or somewhere like that. And just sitting down and stopping the conversation and just literally taking out the comic book again and saying, this is why we're doing this stuff and why we're trying to make this happen. This is what we're trying to achieve. Can you tell us, I'm not a legal expert. I'm not a risk expert. Tell me the right way that we can help make, what would be the right structures to be able to make that happen? And 100% of the time, it gets significantly better. And then they're able to kind of, okay, that's what you're trying to do. And what about this? Have you tried that? What do you think about this structure? And that's how we've been able to get these things moving forward. So it's that combination of trying to align incentives and then also constructing a narrative for them over and over and over again, so that everyone can stay on the same page. Mm-hmm.
And it's another change, though, just to even push that stuff forward. I mean, what is the shift that you think needs to happen to make sure that people are having those conversations? Something gets log jammed and they take the time to sit back with those people that they may have never met, people in risk, people in legal, people who are holed away somewhere in a very, very large building, and have that conversation that they may not even think that they need to do that. All they know is that, I don't know, we hit a wall. What's the shift that needs to happen to get people to recognize that roadblocks can be, overcome?
Yeah, and I think it goes back to, once again, just being intentional, right? If you see the primary issue to getting anything accomplished are people, then you put the vast majority of your effort in identifying those processes and those things in order to get people moving. And then tech comes after that, not the other way around. And even though I think other leaders at other companies will say those kinds of things, their actions and their budget actually don't represent that. For me, that's the focus. It's primarily about people that have technical solutions. And I actually see our most disruptive innovation being around solving people problems. Everyone focuses on the robots and on the stores and space and stuff, which are awesome. But those are manifestations of a process that is primarily a people and organizational focused process, not the other way around.
And I've got one more question for you, sir. If a lot of people are going to listen to this and they're going to hear about the graphic novels and they're going to hear about big words like, you know, manufacturing serendipity and things like that, and they're going to want to find some sort of on the ground way to make this real for their own world. What can they do? What can one person do in order to think differently or to sort of make the next best step towards making an innovation that they envision possible? What can they do?
Yeah. So, maybe I'll start with what not to do first. So I'm glad you brought that up because I can't tell you how many times, someone's come up to me after a talk or sent me an email later on and said, I heard you talk at so-and-so and I went and hired, I made a comic book and it didn't work. I will just say this explicitly. It is not about the comic book. It's not about the story. It's about a system that is, It's a organizational behavior system that happens to use story and comic books as its primary like mechanism for getting to move forward. And so I would read. So in what I would suggest is that every manager reads reads Joseph Campbell and reads some of the the behavioral science books, Thinking Fast and Slow and Predictably Irrational. And some of these other things, which I'm always shocked that people just haven't read yet. And to really try to understand how people make decisions and then start to really lay out a map. You don't have to have a big budget, right, to be able to do these things. Just lay out a map of what you want to do, what you think the areas are, and then to start to lay out what the decision-making structure is to make that happen. Both the overt, this is the actual decision-making structure, and what you think some of the hangups might be of those people that need to get there. That I think would bear more fruit than just about anything else. And then once you kind of get to that point, then you layer story. But story story didn't just work right off the bat. I mean, it took a couple of different iterations to get us to a point where it started to work because it's incredibly complicated. But you can take that organizational principle and understanding and then build on top of that. And then after story comes tech and then better tech and so on and so forth. So starting, I think, really, really thinking through how people make decisions in your organization and the culture and the character of your organization, whether it be in engineering or a sales-based or a tech-based company, those kinds of things really do matter. And then, like I said, doing the next steps.
That's all the time we have. Thanks again, Kyle. And to listen to more podcasts from this series, find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and follow us on SoundCloud. And before we go, one last word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by BNY Mellon Wealth Management, who knows that your investment decisions define not just your future, but your legacy. BNY Mellon Wealth Management knows because they know you well. This gives them the insights to help grow, protect, and transfer your wealth. Visit their brand hub, Worth Knowing, on entrepreneur.com to learn more. Disclaimer, BNY Mellon is the corporate brand of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation and its subsidiaries.